House Judiciary has come to order. It is pretty close to 1, February 15th. President are Representative Thompson, Representative Lynn, Representative Keller. Representative Pruitt has been previously excused. Do you guys want me to stop for anything here?
A lot of activity.
I mean, if you need the floor to yourself, just let me know. Representative Weinberg and Holmes are not yet here. Myself, Representative Gatto. First, housekeeping. You got a cell phone, you know what to do with it. You either give it to me for safekeeping or turn it off. We have 3 new bills, 2 previously scheduled bills, which we'll take up in the order of bills previously heard. First will be SB 30, Return of Seized Property. And we have someone who wants to testify anymore? Or? So we'll have no other testimony on Return of Seized Property. I think we had a... what was the issue that caused us to hold it over? Was there an amendment proposed?
President Greenberg, wasn't it?
Representative Miller to speak to that. Miller, here I go again.
Representative Wilson will do that because Representative Miller is not here right now, sir.
Thank you. So will you speak on her behalf?
I sure will.
Thank you.
Sure. There was an amendment that Representative Greenberg was going to put forward. We have spoken with him, and he has decided to withdraw it.
And he's withdrawn it.
Yes.
In that case, this can go fast. If the amendment is withdrawn, and we've already discussed the bill, and we've closed public testimony, does any member here have any issue they want to discuss? Seeing and hearing none.
We are doing version X, though, right?
Is it X? X like X-ray? Okay.
Okay.
That's the other bill.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the CS for Senate Bill 30, version 27-LS0344/X be advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached corrected physical note.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Any objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill advances from committee. Let's take a short recess so we can sign the documents. Back before you, the next bill to consider is House Bill 296, which is correctional facilities. Crime of escapement, definition of correctional facilities. Right off the bat, Representative Greenberg is offering an amendment labeled D.5, which we will call Amendment Number 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Offer
Amendment Number 3.
Object for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This amendment has been crafted by the Departments of Law and Corrections, and it does 2 things. We have representatives from, I think, both departments here. Is Corrections here?
They're online.
They're online, okay. And we have Annie Carpinetti here. But what the amendment does is 2 things. Number 1, it rewrites Section 3 of the bill. And number 2, it deletes Section 4 of the bill. And it's gone through several iterations, and it's been carefully crafted by those departments. And I am informed it meets with both of their approval. And I would ask that the witnesses be called to verify that.
Okay. I'm looking for a copy of the bill, Melanie. I've got a lot of stuff here, but I don't have the bill.
And for the record, the reason we have the section appealed.
Yeah. It was hidden between amendments. Okay.
Just for the record, even though we're redefining secure correctional facility, the reason in the title we're deleting, quote, relating to the definition of correctional facility is because the secure correctional facility definition is within the crime of escape in the second degree. And so it's within that portion of the title. And we are deleting Section 4, which defines correctional facility. So we no longer have to have that in the title. I just want to put that on the record. And I'd ask if, is Ms. Gutierrez on the line?
Not that I'm aware of.
Who from Corrections on the line?
We have someone online from Corrections.
Well, I know we have Ms. Carpinetti here who can speak for the administration. Maybe we can ask her to come up.
We can.
Corrections is good.
I was incorrect about Corrections.
Welcome once again.
Is this you on the copy?
My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I could just say that Representative Grunberg is correct. We have been working with the Department of Corrections and his office on this proposed change to the definition of secure correctional facility. And Ms. Gutierrez told me she would be online at 1 today, but I know she had another meeting, so I'm not exactly sure what happened to that. But
if I may inquire.
I have talked to her, and she has said it was fine.
Representative Grunberg.
You anticipated my question. You're representing she's okay with the amendment.
Yes, she told me, through the chair, she told me that that the amendment as offered does satisfy her concerns.
Thank you.
Was she sworn in before she told you that? No, okay. Well,
she was not swearing.
Trust is here. So we have the amendment before us. Anyone on the committee want to discuss the amendment? Did you already offer amendment number 3?
I did, and you objected.
And I objected. I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 3 is adopted by the committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
The only other issue had been a question raised by Representative Keller. It didn't relate to an amendment. I understand his concerns have been addressed. Is that right?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Grunberg. I have been assured that my concerns about the definition do not apply to Medicaid funding and will not, because it's confined to the section law. Thank you.
Okay. So we have the bill back before us. We've heard it before. Is there any other comments by the committee?
Or a motion?
Just a minute. Anyone in the audience feel like they absolutely need to testify on this before they leave here? Seeing and hearing no one, anyone online and really want to testify, especially on the amendment? Hearing none, we'll close everything except the committee's vote. Representative, would you like to offer the bill for me, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that House Bill 296, version 27-LS1199, /D.5.
No. D.5 is an amendment. Isn't my right?
Oh, I thought that was a new, okay, version D.
Yeah, version D.
Advanced from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Do I hear an objection? Seeing and hearing none, the bill passes from committee. We'll take a brief pause while we sign the papers. Legislation. Those were previously heard. Now we're getting to the new stuff. So we have House Bill 55, an act adding definitions of gravity knife and switchblade to the criminal law. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and House Judiciary Committee members. My name is Representative Mark Newman, and I represent House District 15, the district that sits in the River Valley, a neighbor to beautiful Palmer Valley. Mr. Chair, members, we'd like to introduce House Bill 55, which we're going to call the Knife Rights Act. This legislation simply clarifies that hunting, fishing, utility knives open with one hand do not qualify as a switchblade and as such are legally owned. Recently, while attending the board meeting of the National Assembly of Sportsmen's Caucus and as avid outdoorsmen, where I try and make sure that I'm informed of what other states are doing, it was brought to our attention that several states had recent court cases requiring the legislature to address clarifying language on knives. I asked my staff to research the issue with Reds Legal, and they found that actually the Alaska Supreme Court had considered how to define gravity knife and switchblades in the absence of a statutory definition, and that's what we're trying to do here. So it's our goal with this legislation to provide clarity for the courts and a preemption language reserving the state's rights to regulate the matter. I felt it necessary to take in a very simple route with the preemption language. This language ensures that a person who buys a knife in the Mat-Su or in my district doesn't have to worry when he travels to Anchorage or other areas of the state that they'd be in violation of a crime, similar to what we did with concealed handgun carry permits. In fact, it's the same language. We just added knives on the end of that. We do have one amendment, Mr. Chair, and I believe that Representative Thompson has that. And I'd like to ask my staff to go into any finer details that you may have. We'll be ready for any questions.
Does your staff have some comments he wants to add, or are you okay?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rex Shattuck. If
you're going to?
I'm fine.
Okay. I always like to hear from the sponsor and their staff, who no doubt did most of the work. Well, Lieutenant Dial, could I have you? I know you got a lot of stuff on your lap there. You almost need your own desk. But I have a question or two for you.
For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Alaska State Troopers.
Okay, thank you, Lieutenant. What I'd like to know is, when you apprehend a suspect and you ask the question, are you carrying any weapons? Knives would be included in weapons. Am I correct?
Mr. Chairman, that would be our expectation, yes.
And does defining different kinds of knives have any effect on the word knives as far as apprehending someone?
Mr. Chairman, no.
No, okay. I kind of thought that would be it. But we're going to make life easier. When you read the bill and it defines switchblades and gravity knives, is there any kind of knife that is, like, let's say it has a detent which keeps it closed under any circumstances? Still, there wouldn't be any exemption. How about if it's only 4 inches long or four fingers wide? Would there be any exceptions to the question, are you carrying any weapons?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Good. That's what I like to hear. Well, do you have any questions for Lieutenant Dial? Anyone here? Thank you for your testimony. It'll take you a minute to get all that stuff back open again, isn't it? Any questions from anyone on the committee?
I'd like to ask Ms. Carpinetti a question.
Okay. Ms. Carpinetti, could you come forward yet once again? I keep thinking you ought to have your own little desk on the side in judiciary, you know.
Box seat.
Again, I'm Annie Carpinetti from the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember a number of years ago when we had a knife bill, and I don't see it here in the packet. It may be referenced in the Strange case. That's with a capital S. And I remember discussions on switchblades and stuff like that. Maybe you can give us the background on where these are prohibited and what this bill will do and what effect this, if any, this will have on the outcome in the Strange case. That's State v. Strange.
Through the chair, I'd have to review State versus Strange, and maybe I could just take a quick read of that.
Sure.
But I can answer your other questions, which are 1161. It's misconduct involving weapons, and I believe the third degree or fourth degree, it's a Class A misdemeanor, prohibits the manufacture, sale, or transfer of a gravity knife or a switchblade knife. So this...
That's 1161 what?
I'm just getting it for you. 1161210A5. So that's a Class A, makes it a Class A misdemeanor to manufacture, sell, or transfer a switchblade or gravity knife.
That's
so
pretty much of a quote. A person commits a crime of misconduct involving weapons in the fourth degree if the person manufactures, possesses, transports, sells, or transfers a switchblade or gravity knife. That's the quote from the whole statute.
Right. And that's a Class A misdemeanor. So this would this bill would clarify that for purposes of at least this statute and maybe others, what is not included and what is not prohibited are these other knives that have that meet this qualifying language after the definition. So it at spring or detent, I'm not familiar with that, or other mechanism that helps open or close would not be prohibited under misconduct involving weapons in the fourth degree. Also, the crime of misconduct involving weapons in the fifth degree prohibits the possession of a switchblade knife or a gravity knife.
And where is that? What's the sub number on that?
That is AS 1161-220, let's see, A5.
Okay, and that says a person commits a crime of misconduct involving weapons of the fifth degree if the person possesses or transports a switchblade or gravity knife.
And that conduct is a Class B misdemeanor.
Okay. Could I inquire?
Please.
So, if a person manufactures, let's say you are there, and I would ask somebody, maybe not you, maybe somebody else, if you don't know, somebody, are there not manufacturers in the United States who manufacture gravity knives and switchblade knives for sale in places where they're legal?
You'd have to ask.
I think Mr. Shattuck may know that.
My name is Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Newman and sponsor the bill. You might find online there's an individual who could better answer that question. He's a knife rights national organization.
I'd rather?
Yes.
He's not here, though.
No, he's online.
He's online.
Oh, maybe we could ask him.
He might better be able to address that.
Todd Rather, are you online? You know.
Hello, can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Oh, quite well. Can you introduce yourself? And I see you're from out of state. And tell us there what organization you are part of, and then go ahead and we'll get some questions and see what we can come up with.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. My name is Todd Rather, and I represent Knife Rights, which is a national knife collectors and owners association similar to the National Rifle Association.
And for the record, we do have a letter from you dated February 15th of 12. It's a nice colorful paper in our packet. And did you want to give us some testimony first or just answer questions?
I'll be happy to do testimony. It's very short. And then I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to thank you and the committee for testify, and there's an old expression that the devil is in the details, and when it comes to knife regulation, that's certainly the case. All around the United States, the definition of what knives are legal or illegal is in the details of that definition. We're seeing an increase of prosecutions of people for possessing so-called switchblades and gravity knives, and while knife rights thinks that there should be no ban on these knives, some states have them, and Alaska is one of them. If the Alaska legislature is not ready to repeal these bans, then we would strongly urge you to adopt the definitions contained in HB 55. These definitions clearly define what is or is not a switchblade. And what's happening is that we're seeing all around the country, in certain places, New York City, for instance, where everyday pocket knives are being defined as switchblades and gravity knives, and police are arresting people and prosecutors are prosecuting people for these knives, and we're working on a nationwide effort to fix that, and we believe that HB 55 will help fix that in Alaska. Whether there's prosecutions or not currently going on in Alaska is really not the question. It is, do we want someone who's an otherwise law-abiding citizen to get hung up on something like this, and the law enforcement have to have questions about what is a switchblade, what's a gravity knife, and so on and so forth. To address the amendment on preemption, it simply means that the laws that your body, your legislature, pass in Juneau will apply equally to all Alaskans, which makes it easier and we believe more fair to the average law-abiding citizen, and need to be duly enforced by law enforcement. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have about other states or manufacturers or things like that.
Okay, let me start with a question. A lot of Alaskans who have been here a long time have a multitude of knives, one of which that's commonly carried is the sheath knife. Another one might be a filleting knife that simply folds, and the only way to get it open is to stick your fingernail in the slot and pull it open. So those two knives are outside of the definition of gravity knives and switchblades, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. Representative Grunberg?
Okay. What is this? Oh, I have that. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Rathner, two questions. Ms. Carpinetti read misconduct involving weapons in the fourth degree, which states that the person commits that crime, which is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by up to a year in jail and a fine. If the person manufactures, possesses, transports, sells, or manufactures, sells, or transfers a switchblade or gravity knife, what I'm interested in finding out is whether there are manufacturers, commercial companies, in Alaska or other states that legitimately and legally manufacture these knives, and whether that is legal and can be used in any jurisdiction within the United States, or maybe even for export. In other words, I'm concerned that we don't criminalize legitimate businesses who are in the business of manufacturing. That's my first question. Could you answer that through the chair?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. There are certainly manufacturers in the United States that manufacture switchblade knives and may even manufacture what some would call gravity knives, but certainly they manufacture switchblades. I'm not aware of any switchblade manufacturers in the state of Alaska at the moment, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. As a matter of fact, we're working on a bill right now with your neighbor to the south in Washington State so that they can legally manufacture knives there because switchblade knives there because it's currently illegal to do so, and they have contracts with the United States military and law enforcement to produce these knives, and they're stuck in a quandary where they have to go out of state to produce them. Even though the contract may be executed in Washington State, they're having to go to other states to manufacture them, which means that those jobs and whatever revenues are going to those other states. And so the state of Washington is currently trying to make it legal to manufacture automatic knives or switchblade knives in the state of Washington. There are a number of manufacturers of switchblades in the lower 48 that I'm aware of in Oregon and in other states that are currently manufacturing those knives. Does that answer your question, Mr. Representative?
Mr. Chair, if I may have a little leeway, could we ask Ms. Carpinetti to come back? I'd like to alternate questions between these two witnesses, if I may.
Could you just move over and get her a chair next to you?
Mr. Shattuck, through the chair, Mr. Shattuck, were you going to say something?
Mr. Chairman, there is another gentleman online, Ray Tebow, who actually owns Alaska Knives and Northern Knives, excuse me, in Anchorage, and he would probably have a good idea of his suppliers as well.
Okay, well, I'm not sure. It's a legal question I have. Through the chair, if I may.
Go ahead.
Ms. McCarthy, my first question to you, and I'm going to have a second line of questioning here for both of you. And I'm looking at the Section 210, fourth degree statute, where the word says manufactures. And I'm wondering if a person manufactures and ships, or just even manufactures, because they don't have to transport it, if you've got a company in another state where it's legal to do so, could they, and the knife winds up here, could that out-of-state company be charged?
That's through the chair. That's an interesting question, whether or not we can charge people for violating Alaska law that has been mainly committed outside the state. Sometimes we can, if the harm is very immediate in our state, for example, a person steals the identity of somebody outside the state and the victim is in state and the victim is suffering harm in the state. I guess I'd have to give it some thought before I could give you a definitive answer about manufacturing a switchblade and then being subject to this law.
Yeah, I'd like that to be done because that's a serious thing, and I'm sure that the sponsor would not want to punish legitimate manufacturers who are operating legally, and a knife just happens to wind up in Alaska. That's my first question. My second question is, since no mental intent is mentioned either in fourth degree or fifth degree misconduct statutes, it talks about, for example, possessing or transporting, and that's in the fifth degree, selling or transferring. Well, I'm sure a person would know if they're doing that, but particularly transporting or possessing. What is the mental state required for that?
Through the chair, the culpable mental state for conduct when it's not specified in the particular statute is knowing. So the person, where the state would have to prove that the person knowingly manufactured, sold, or transferred a switchblade, or knowingly possessed those items.
Oh, that's good, because a little knife could wind up in your pocket and you not be aware of
it. Box.
Or a knapsack or something.
Your glove box and you're driving around, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I am concerned about the first question, and I'd like to be sure that we're not, and I realize that's not in the current language of the bill, and that this statute was written when I was on this committee a number of years ago, and I don't know why we didn't define any of this stuff to begin with, but.
Speaking of definitions, we have in some of the comments, especially from Dan Wayne, he used the word butterfly knife and balisong knife. I don't know either one of those. Representative, no. Mr. Shattuck?
Representative Gatto, members of the committee, Rex Shattuck. A butterfly knife is a knife that was glorified probably by Hollywood. It had a fixed center shaft and two outside pieces. Mm-hmm. When the latch was undone on the backside, it would fold open, and you saw in lots of Hollywood movies the quick action of the hand, gravity knife, and that's what a butterfly knife was. A billisong knife was very similar.
Okay. I do have another question that just came to mind. If we try to drive home through Canada, it says no guns, or does it say no weapons are allowed?
President Ogato, when I've driven through Canada a number of times, they've specifically asked about guns.
They use the word guns rather than carrying any weapons?
Guns more specifically.
Okay. So what one would guess then, their prime concern is a gun and not the general category of weapons.
Mr. Chair, if they're worried about knives, then I'd be in.
We're all going to be guilty. Yeah. Could have a little mess kit with a knife in it, too. Mm-hmm. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, I don't know if you had a chance to look at that strange case, but do you have Dan Wayne's memo?
No, I don't.
Okay. Do you have a copy of it there? Ms. Carpinetti, here, you can look at mine. That's my only copy. Okay. He indicates that butterfly knives and balisong, is that how you pronounce it? Balisong?
Balisong
knives, thank you. Apparently, are not within the definition of gravity knives. Does this bill change that, or would the result in Strange be the same once we pass this bill?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I suspect that since the Court of Appeals in Strange determined that these two types of knives were not gravity or switchblade knives, they would continue not to be under the new definition because that is limiting the definition anyway. So I would assume that they would not fit in.
Well, if when we when you and I read these cases, maybe if the result changes, if you'd let me know, please.
Sure, sure. And actually, as I looked at it, it did come to mind. I remember this decision.
Okay. I notice under knife definitions, which probably came from Strange, where it says, several states, California, Illinois, Michigan, Texas, all have ruled in favor of assisted opening and one-hand opening knives. These knives are not considered switchblades because they do not possess the activating button for device on the handle of the knife. Well, I'm confused because if you're able to open a knife with one hand without an assist button, you must be pretty dexterous or have one heck of a thumb or...
Give a demo.
You're not carrying an example for us, are you?
I have several knives, actually, that if it pleases the chair, maybe I could take them out.
It pleases me a lot.
There are any number of, and I am not accomplished, but a regular buck knife, there are people who are very accomplished in opening them one-handed. The problem is, if we understand the history of a switchblade being something that a sailor might have used on a ship in a dire situation to cut a line or something like that, the speed in which you do it is difficult. Nonetheless, there are still many folks who can open knives quite quickly.
Yeah, but you were just using two hands.
That's because I'm not accomplished at it. These knives that many hunters, fishermen, and craftsmen in the state of Alaska and around the country use speed that process up. And so this is the sort of knife that we're addressing not being a switchblade. If you notice, it opens up to about half or three-quarter. It has a bias-loading close. Yet on the backside, on the blade itself, there is an assist that allows you to open the knife conveniently and quickly one-handed. So if you were taking care of a moose or a fish and you were holding some particular part and you wanted to have your knife out to do whatever it is you're doing, they quickly open.
Doesn't that make it a switchblade then?
That is the point of this legislation, is so that it is not considered a switchblade. If you notice on these knives as well, there is a mechanism right there by which you can also use one hand to open it.
But you also demonstrated that with one hand you can depress the latch and it sprang open.
Well,
all the way.
One hand right here on the back of the blade, it doesn't open all the way unless you really exert some force. Okay. The point being is they're bias-loaded close, unlike a switchblade, whereas if you press the button, the knife will come out very fast, and if you press the button, it'll come back in. That's the difference between a switchblade and this sort of knife. 80% of the knives being sold in the country today, according to industry,
are
like this.
Got it.
Most of them are?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, I still have my Boy Scout knife.
Mr. Thebault, for our business owner from Anchorage, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
I have another hearing that I have.
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
If I could get the...
All right.
You have testimony. First of all, give us your name. Spell your last name for the person who's trying to get the recording done correctly. And then give us your testimony.
All right. My name is Ray Thebault. Spelled T-H-I-B-A-U-L-T, and I am an owner of Northern Knives in Anchorage, Alaska. And just briefly in testimony, I think the definitions are excellent. They will help clarify things. I would have nothing negative to say about them. The preemption portion of it, and pardon me if I step over something, but I was cut off for just 2 or 3 minutes and I had to recall. But for the state preemption, I think that would be another great thing because it would simplify, it would make the law uniform across the state so that a fisherman that comes in at Seward can travel up to Anchorage, and if he has to do business at Fairbanks, he can go on up there without ever thinking about that he's unwittingly compromising himself by breaking the law in some little local community. Beyond that, I'll be happy to answer questions at all. at this point.
Representative Grunberg?
I actually have a question, and it was probably for somebody else. And it deals with the amendment. May I ask a question on the amendment to anybody who can answer?
Sure.
Okay. I am looking at the amendment. Are you going to label that for discussion, Amendment 1 or something, so we can talk?
Give us the amendment, because I just got an amendment from another bill mixed in here, and now I'm wondering.
A1.
LS0298/A.1.
And just for discussion, so we have something before us, I'll offer the amendment, then I can discuss it.
Okay, so we'll call A.1, Amendment Number 1, and you're moving the amendment?
Yeah.
I'll object for discussion with Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving some latitude since we're kind of looking at the whole bill here. Looking at, and this is not in the current amendment, but it's something, and we, those of us who have been around for 10 years, remember this was the Chenault bill a number of years ago, I believe, on municipalities. I'm looking at Section 4, lines 16 to 17. Municipalities may enact and enforce ordinances that are identical to state law and that have the same penalty as provided for by state law. And my question is this. I'm not sure whether a municipality has the authority to enact a Class A misdemeanor. If somebody can ask that, because it may be that that would basically divest the municipalities of anything. It says, now it says, that are identical to state law and have the same penalty as provided for by state law. And I'm just wondering, and I don't know if you folks know or anybody else knows, or Lieutenant Dial or any of the folks, do municipalities like Anchorage have the authority to enact Class A misdemeanors?
I have a question about that. What is the value, the advantage in offering an ordinance that simply copies the state law? I mean, the state law is the state law. Whether you propose an ordinance or not, it's almost like proposing an ordinance complicates things, because someone may come along and want to modify the ordinance, not realizing that it's state law.
That's a good point. And I was one of the people to vote against that bill years ago for various reasons. But is there anybody that could answer either the chairman or my question? Anybody in the audience or online? Don't know. This goes beyond knives. It goes to, you know.
Yeah.
At least involving weapons.
Well,
it was a gun bill.
And on line 18, number 2, restricting the discharge of firearms, we seem to have diverged from knives into firearms.
Oh, this is broader, because the only thing that we're doing on page 2 to that ordinance is adding knives, Chairman.
Okay.
Yeah, but the ordinance is basically before us, and, you know, I'm just curious. I didn't mean to diverge.
I think the bill sponsor wants to
Chair?
Begin.
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Newman?
Mr. Chair, again, what we're trying to do with this presumptive clause is add clarification, just as what we're trying to do is to make sure that we have definitions for the types of knives that are used in Alaska. And, again, this was legislation that was passed under Representative Chenault's bill, I believe, in 2004, that dealt with concealed handgun carry permits, so that other municipalities may have different restrictions on carrying those. So if you had one and it was legal in your municipality or where you live, you entered into another municipality that had different laws, that state law preempts local law, that you do have the right to carry that, and takes that confusion out of that. We tried to make sure that's why we just use this language that has already been through the legislature and looked at, been through the legislative process, that discovery process that we go through, and simply use this form to make sure that we added and knives onto that, because it's already been through this process, the legislative process that we follow.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
one collateral
affect, and I appreciate that, yeah, you're right, Representative Newman, but when collateral result of allowing ordinance to cover this, and I think in some municipalities, maybe including Anchorage, the municipal attorney may only enforce ordinances. I don't know if they do. Anybody know? Do they have the authority to enforce state law? Because only the DA does that.
A question for Lieutenant Dial.
I can enforce the law myself.
Can the municipality enforce a state law?
Not a lawyer.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is
okay.
They can.
Representative Grunberg? Yeah, he said yes, they can.
I'm talking about prosecuting. I didn't mean it when I said enforcing. I meant prosecuting in court. When you're a lawyer, yeah, you can.
Mr. Chairman? Sure.
Yeah.
Mr. Shannon, you spoke to legislative legal about how we should structure preemptive language. They, having confidence in the bill previously passed, said this would be the cleanest and simplest way since it was well understood what preemption meant in the case of handguns, and it would not cause a conflict by adding knives to it.
I want to welcome Representative Holmes to the committee. Thank you for attending.
Sorry.
It's all right. So we're almost to full strength, but Representative Pruitt has an excused absence. So what to do? Representative Grunberg?
I had offered the amendment, and I'd ask if the objection could be withdrawn so we incorporate the amendment.
Was it my objection?
Yes, it was.
Was my objection? I'll withdraw my objection. Is there any other objection? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. Okay. Are there any other amendments? Seeing and hearing none, this brings us back to House Bill 55, definitions of gravity and switchblade knives. Representative Grunberg?
I had asked a question that was directed to Ms. Carpinetti. She's gone. I don't need to have that answered in this committee. The bill, I guess it just goes to the floor from here, doesn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes.
Well, we can look at that down the line, wherever. So I have no objection.
What was the question you had? Something to do with strange or?
Oh, what it had to do with was the word manufacture and whether we're going to have a problem potentially with trying to prosecute a manufacturer that may be in Washington or somewhere else under misconduct in the fourth degree. I think that's an issue that can be looked at down the line and or wherever. I certainly think this is a good bill, and I think that
we had an issue where if you totally manufactured a firearm in the state, is that where you're going with this one? Yeah, did that fall under the federal requirements? And most people said it does not. So you're free to manufacture a weapon or a firearm. Now, I would assume the same thing would apply. We have people that make knives all the time. In fact, if we were to go in Mr. T-Bolt's store, heaven only knows how many different knives he has in that store. I mean, everybody here, I own probably seven different knives, if only seven. Starting with the famous buck knife back in 68, I still have it. Still works. So, any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, so that you know, online and listening is a very well-known manufacturer of knives by the name of C.J. Buck.
Oh, is that right?
He's listening through the Internet.
Oh, Mr. Chair, maybe we could ask those other witnesses if they have anything to say.
You mean Mr. Buck? Is he really
on? There was somebody
listening on. He's listening through our wonderful system on his computer.
Okay.
Connecticut, I think. I don't know where Buck Nation manufactured.
Well, Mr. Buck, if you're listening, I bought my knife in 68, and it's still my favorite knife, so good quality product with brass edges and good steel.
I think there was somebody from Northern Knives. I didn't know.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Ray Tebow.
He's still online, I believe.
Okay.
We're good? anybody in the audience want to testify? Seeing and hearing none, anybody online that happens to be listening that would like to add a comment? Getting no response, we'll close public testimony, brings it back to the committee. We have before us House Bill 55, version A. Representative Thompson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move House Bill 55, version 27-LS0298/A as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero physical note.
We're seeing objection, hearing objection, seeing objection, seeing and hearing none. House Bill 55 advances from committee. We'll take a moment to sign the paperwork. Congratulations, Representative. Is back. We'll take House Bill 262, sponsored by Representative Cisna, which has to do with passenger security related to, I'm sure, TSA pat-downs and magnetic imaging and gosh knows what else. Representative Cisna, would you come forward and tell us about your bill?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would like to have my staff join me if that's
sure.
All right.
No problem.
I'm sorry.
Good grief. Okay, who wants to speak first?
I'd love to introduce myself and my staff.
Okay.
Begin with Mr. Chair, and thank you very much. For the record, my name is Sharon Cisna, and I'm a state representative with District 22 in Anchorage. And we're talking about House Bill 262, and I'd like to start out with my staff person, Lanzana White, on my left, and then when we go into a little bit more description, it will be Mark Sable, also to my left. And so I'll start with Lanzana.
Good afternoon.
Okay. Got to put your name on the record and spell it.
Yes. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lanzana White. It's spelled M-I-L-E-S-A-N-N-A. And I'm staffed representative Sharon Cisna. HB 262 relates to air travel screening procedures that have begun in Alaska. On October 28, 2010, the Transportation Security Agency began using its new modified screening areas in lower 48 airports. These areas were initially set up for a security enforcement process to protect
air... Can you slow down a little bit?
Sorry.
You're probably nervous. Well, none of us here are a villain. And I think it'd be easier on us if you slow down a little bit. It seems like you're just trying to get through this and get out of here as fast as you can.
No, that's not the case. These areas were initially set up for a security enforcement process to protect air travelers in the wake of the September 11th air attacks. During December of 2011, the Anchorage Ted Stevens International Airport was the first site in the state of Alaska where TSA implemented these new screening procedures. Final passage of HB 262 would safeguard our state's public airports from the unintended consequences of inappropriate security searches. The bill does this by making it a Class A misdemeanor for any individual, including TSA employees, to require an individual to submit to an electronic body imager or to direct physical contact before being granted access to public transportation. I will now turn it, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to now turn it over to my colleague, Mark Sable.
Okay. Introduce yourself. Give us a spelling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Mark Sable, M-A-R-K-S-A-B-E-L. I am an aide to Representative Cisna, and I'm going to be going through the next few PowerPoint slides. Just very quickly, a little history. Hijacking in the U.S. really came about in the 60s. And if any of you will just remember, it peaked with planes going to Cuba, which was in 1969. There was a dramatic drop-off in the number of hijackings following that. And though we don't have diplomatic relations with Cuba, they think that arrangements worked out to prevent that. Things changed dramatically, as we all remember, from September 9th, 2001. That's, okay. TSA was created. I actually have the date. it was November of 2001, in the wake of the 9/11 hijackings and subsequent intentional crashes, TSA was created. There are 450 airports under its control currently, where they screen passengers as well as checked and carry-on baggage. Today, and you can see right here, the accelerated use of scanners and invasive inspections have become a focus of TSA following two incidents. That was the shoe bomber and the underwear bomber. Both those planes took off from outside the jurisdiction of the United States. There's nothing TSA stateside really could have done to prevent either one of those. And I distinctly remember the shoe bomber because my shoes were off in the Petersburg airport the day that happened, and everybody's socks got totally soaked.
If I remember correctly, a passenger next to him saw him with a lighter trying to ignite his shoes, and that got their attention.
No. Well, that's something. Prior to 9/11, it was pretty much understood by passengers that the plane's hijacked, remain docile, because chances are they just want money. Just let them do their thing, or maybe get a flight out of the country. Post 9/11, that has totally changed. Both the shoe bomber and the underwear bomber were detained by the passengers. People are not going to let passengers run roughshod over flights anymore. And I found something interesting in reading. It was 1961 or 1962 since the last time a bomb went off on an American airliner that actually killed someone. So it's been 50 years. Next slide.
Do TSA agents carry weapons?
They do not, to my knowledge, because as you'll see in the middle slide, they are not peace officers, referred to as transportation security officers, but they have no actual police power. That's why whenever you go to a TSA secured area, you'll also see a uniformed policeman there, because all a TSA security officer can do is usher over an actual law enforcement official. And that's, if you've noticed, the badges have changed. Just a few years ago, it was a fabric badge sewn onto the TSA officer's uniform. Now they're actually shiny metallic badges, which gives the impression that they're security officers or peace officers, when in fact they aren't. And the budget keeps going up for TSA. It's now up to about $8.1 billion. And it was $6.4 billion in 2008.
Is all of that from passenger, where it says taxes and security?
I was trying to find the breakdown of that, and I was not able to do that.
I have another question. 45,000 are officers, 58,000 are employees, 13,000 are supervisors?
Air marshals. There's a lot of other things. There's air marshals. There is also land-based transportation that they check on. There are a lot of functions they perform beyond just security screening of passengers.
Well, I see them walking around the airport carrying clipboards. They come in and out of rooms, they carry clipboards, they talk to somebody, and then they disappear again. I'm just surprised that there are so many of them myself, but now that I see the numbers, if you got 58,000 people to go to all the airports, you need a lot in each airport.
We should just confiscate the clipboards.
Yeah.
Okay, continue.
Thank you. As we all know, Alaska is a very unique place. That's why we love living here so much. Traveling Alaska is unique, and I'm just going to run through these because the time is short. Alaskans fly 8 times more than the national average. We fly a lot. Occupational lifestyles of the people who work here, far different than many states. If you're living in Connecticut, we're at high risk for both physical damage and emotional trauma. In most of Alaska, air flight is not an option. It is the only method to travel great distances during winter. Many Alaskans require air flight to reach advanced medical care. Alaska has the highest per capita number of military veterans, many of whom have suffered either physical or mental injury during their service in the country. And we also have the fastest growing population of seniors. So Alaska leads the nation, of course, in severe Arctic weather that we have to contend with. and the distances between our communities are such that we can't just jump on a country back road and go visit our cousins. We need to get on a plane a lot of times. So air travel is far more critical to Alaskans than it is to probably any other state in the country. And that concludes my portion of this testimony. And I'd like to hand it back over to Representative Sisna.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And again, it's Representative Sisna. And I'd like to underline the fact that this is really a constitutional issue. And it really is a constitutional issue in two ways, two important ways. And it's the two things that we make pledges at the beginning of our terms to the two different constitutions, that of the state of Alaska and that of the United States. And in looking at these two different constitutions, it's very, it's really an emotional experience hearing about the, or reading about the Declaration of Rights in the Alaskan Constitution, Section 14, Searches and Seizures, that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and other property, papers, and effects against reasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. No warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be searched. And that does sound like this bill. The United States Constitution in the Bill of Rights and the Amendment 4, the right of people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons and things to be seized. This is the issue that that I will say personally I heard from after myself having an experience with the Transportation Security Administration in Seattle was people's concern about constitutional rights. And I wasn't thinking constitutional as much as I was thinking my own rights. It was a very personal experience. What this bill, which is a complicated bill, and I'd like to explain that a little bit, what it would do is to ensure Alaskans' ability to move with confidence, unhindered, within the state. Within the state. This is what this bill does. People will be free from the fear of their bodies being violated. And if, in fact, you're a person who is healthy, usually that's the younger bodies are the ones less likely to show up in scanners as having some kind of difference to them. Differences are going to be alerting the agents and the workers at TSA that a search is necessary. This bill would make the privacy of the individual as required by the U.S. and state constitution to be restored. And in the present situation, what happens is for those people who, like myself, like so many people who in my category as a senior are going to be shown as having an anomaly in my body, and that means not what I'm going to call what you will read. I see it as a physical examination, and I'm not going to call it anything other than that, because what happened to me was very invasive physical examination. This is an issue really about the promises that have been made to our country, to the people in this country. And it's a promise in the constitutions that say that there are ways that we should be protected against seizures when in fact We have not done anything wrong, and there's no proof of that. This is in our Constitution. We've made similar promises in some of the horrible things that we've been seeing happen around the state. And one of the things that we've started leading the country in is domestic violence. And this morning I woke up thinking about domestic violence and thinking about this in a more distant way and thinking about Big Daddy, who is perpetrating violence, assault on his family. That's not something any one of us want to think about, but it happens. And looking at it in a much bigger way, when we are a state, and when the people of our state are being touched, treated in very wrong ways, do we stand by? Because, and that you will find about that more as we look at this, that the federal government trumps us on laws. We are second place here, even though it's people who are neighbors of ours, people who we know, people maybe in our own families. We do not have a say because the federal government trumps us. And this law, as it is written, it actually uses the law of the state of Alaska on touch, on abuse. It uses exactly the language. It's referring straight to that. This is happening to our people. The way that we wrote this law does use our state. It is trumped by the federal government. And what happens if, in fact, this passes? Well, if you were watching the news this last year, what you saw was the state of Texas. And the state of Texas actually had a bill relatively similar to this one, based on their laws of indecent touch. But it still threatened the federal government's right to determine what the laws were in their state. This law does the same thing. That law, politics were what ended the bill. In this state, we did a forum in our Legislative Health Caucus, which is focused on health, and the experiences people have at the airport are health-related in more ways than one, not just the abuse, but in other ways as well. And what we did was, because this is an issue, we invited a representative from the Attorney General's office, and this was the former Attorney General, and you have as a handout, the handout that has the, it has a, let's see, it's that, excuse me, and we've got some on the outside table as well, so that people can see it. And I guess maybe I don't even have it. It's this one right here. And what it has included on it, and Mr. Chair, I will admit, this is a long discussion. We don't have time for that. And what I want to do is at least call the members' awareness to the fact that what this document has is the testimony that was given in the Health Caucus about from people who had many different reasons why they were concerned about this issue. And in it is the words, most of the words that the representative of the Attorney General's office gave and the report she gave us as well. So it goes into the documented legal framework of TSA's charge in our state. And her comments were that legally, throughout the nation, all of the cases that have brought this to court, and court is, interestingly enough,
The United States court system is the alternative to a, they're the other part of the powers, and they're the alternative force that can have something to say about what happens when something horrifying happens and two separate bodies are not able to come to the two other bodies are not able to come to agreement. And she believes that the reason that it's never been able to be solved in court is because of the jurisdiction that is used in each case when this legislation has gone to court, that they've never been brought to the right court. I would suggest this as something that this committee do study, and since what I'd like to do, this is an issue that actually has complications, because when it was first written, when this bill was first written, we did not have a TSA screening capacity here that fit the law that they or the rules that they put in place in October of 2010. And that was for a full body scan to be brought to Alaska with the invasive physical examination. And what they brought instead is, as I understand it, a X-ray process. And so the bill actually does not describe that right. And what has also been happening in the months since this was written is numbers of conversation that I and others have had across the country, because throughout the United States, other states are realizing the only way that we're really going to be able to change the United States and Congress is to get their attention, to have them understand exactly what states are finding with these procedures. And we asked last year for there to be a hearing sent, and we sent that letter. In fact, one of your members of the committee sent that letter. We've never gotten a reply. And we sent a resolution to Congress asking for there to be a hearing in, to do oversight and to also pay attention to the state of Alaska. We've never gotten a response. The governor of this state has sent a letter asking for a health study to the TSA offices, and I believe it's Director Pistole. And my latest question of the governor's office is there's never been a response. And so what I am hoping that this committee would be willing to do is for there to be work to develop a committee substitute, or to have a subcommittee that is worked on with all of the incoming information that we do need to craft something that really does the job right. And this committee is the committee that will really know whether or not judicially it's possible to do this. This does require some work on that part. But I think, even though this is a tremendously challenging thing to do, is to sue, or actually not to sue, to put into place something that the federal government would probably sue us on, to actually take that step for the people of the state, because we lead in so many traumatic injuries that people have had, sometimes with war, sometimes with work experience, sometimes because of family problems, but nonetheless, we lead the nation in those conditions, and it's eight times the national average that our people are going to be having re-traumatization at the airport. So, Mr. Chair, that's, I think, the end of my presentation about this bill.
We have a system that's coming online, Trusted Traveler, where you can apply
as a trusted traveler, and you wouldn't have to be, you go to the same line as the pilots and crew goes through. They don't take their shoes off, and I don't think they go through scanners either. They have a pretty good ID card. And what would be your suggestion that we do? Not that we avoid, but that we actually do.
Mr. Chair, I actually don't know the rules in a committee. And can I talk about another piece of legislation?
Like dealing with fisheries or, you know, give me some background here.
Well, there was a bill read across this morning and on the floor, and it's another part of this, and that part is for there to be a state airport, and it'd be each airport, that deals with the TSA system that has this kind of procedure, to opt out of the TSA managing those airports. And we actually have corporations in this state have tried to put together proposals to do exactly that, to manage our airports, because in fact our state requires, I believe, and many others believe, more quality in security. We need better security.
Yeah. I think we're allowed to opt out of TSA, but we have to have TSA personnel overseeing us.
They do, yeah. They put in, and apparently what I have heard is that Congress right now is having hearings, and we watched some of it, because they're sending so many of their own people over to the privately managed managed airports. So it is an extraordinarily important issue in terms of finances. And by the way, there was a question that was asked on why has the cost gone up so extremely. And it's because in October of 2010, we brought in the full body scanners. And those scanners have been going in across the country, and it's many tens of thousands per scanner is my understanding of those. And there being sometimes there's many of them in individual airports. And places like Canada even have those scanners. Any place that actually is having flights that come to the United States is supposed to have that same procedure given. So it's a lot of money, and it's a lot of jobs that are coming with that.
Hold on. Go ahead. Finish your sentence.
Well, I'm really thinking in terms of the importance to understand Alaska and the challenges that Alaska has and the possible hazards that Alaska face for the security procedures. And I think having Alaskans be the ones that work there is a really good idea.
Yeah, I think the original full-body scanners did show a pretty good image of an individual, and the newer model shows a generic image, not a stick figure, but everybody gets the same image.
That's what I understand.
But, of course, that means we had to buy the old ones and buy the new ones and hire more people, and it's quite an industry. Representative Hillin.
I thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Testimony. You're testifying before a standing committee here. Now, earlier, and this benefit mainly for those who may be watching on gavel or whatever, you indicated that somebody from the Department of Law gave testimony to the Health Caucus. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but testimony is only given before a legislative committee or special committee. A caucus is basically a group of a voluntary group of people who share a common interest in something. I might have a beard caucus, might have an old guy caucus, or I might have a health caucus. But these are not official things. I don't know that that's really testimony. It may be comments, but not testimony. It's kind of official. We have folks here taking notes and going on the official record, so I'm not sure that the Department actually testified one way or the other on these issues that you bring up.
Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and through the chair. Well, I think the dictionary and synonyms always come up with these words, and so you are right. It was an unofficial
invited guest.
They were invited guests for sure, and yeah, this was
not official testimony.
It's not official testimony the way that it would be here.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Representative Sisna, I'm not sure on this, but I was told that page 2 of your bill states that that this section does not include federal buildings.
Right.
And I was told that at the present time, the way that they have changed things around, that the security portion of the airports are now owned by the federal government, so this would have no power over the TSA. I don't know this, but that's what I've been informed, that the federal government now claims that they own the security portions of airports, so this bill would have no effect on them.
Mr. Chair.
Is that assistant?
Through the chair. The airports in Alaska, it's really kind of interesting in Alaska. The Department of Transportation has told us that there are, I think it's 4 community-owned airports in Alaska, and it's somewhere right close to 20 that are the airports are owned by the state government, and it's the Department of Transportation that runs them. So this is different, and this is different than most of the places in the country, and they are very proud, the Department of Transportation, on how many airports they actually have in this state.
Well, that's an interesting question. Does the federal government own or administer a certain part of the airport which makes it federal property, much like other areas? Air Force Base is federal property, even though it's in the community.
Mr. Chair, you will find that mentioned in the Health Caucus discussion. Mm-hmm. And we've had a number of people telling us that, for instance, I talked to the manager of the Juneau Airport, and one of the issues that happens is that TSA will come into an airport and they tell them what space they need. And then the airport tries very hard to have the things they say they need, but it's a communication process. They don't actually rent the space, is my understanding, but they tell the airport what they need.
So they own it without paying for it?
They don't own it. It's owned by the municipality here in Juneau, for instance. And Ted Stevens International Airport is owned by the state.
But the ground that they're, where they're in charge, somehow, if it's federal property that they don't own, it's just a difficult term for me, that it can be federal property that the feds don't own. I guess it could be, but I haven't heard of a situation like that.
Is administered the word that we're looking for here? Because it's an administration issue.
Maybe. Any other questions? Representative Keller.
I just want to say thank you for calling this to our attention. Your slide on the Alaska Constitution and the U.S. Constitution are very interesting. You read those carefully, and it sounds like to me that Congress, in my interpretation, has stepped over the line and making the law. And you said, I believe in your testimony, that we understand that federal law supersedes state law. And that's a very frustrating situation to be in. And but I commend you for bringing it forward, because I was just, as you were talking, I went back and thumbed through the Declaration of Independence. And I don't know if you realize it or not, but two-thirds of it is just exactly this, documenting offenses of the king, building up for the time when we said no, we're not going farther. And so sometimes that's all we can do is document it. So I want to thank you for bringing it forward and going on the record and pointing this out.
Okay. Let's hear from Patricia Anderson, Alaska Freedom to Travel. Patricia, are you able to talk to us?
Patricia Anderson.
Okay. You will have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Judiciary Committee. Thank you for letting me speak in favor of House Bill 262. My name is Patricia Anderson. I reside in Anchorage. I returned last night from a five-day trip to Seattle to watch my daughter in the last swim conference in her college career. I got the enhanced pat-down as I refused to go through both the millimeter wave or the backscatter x-ray machines. I'm not convinced they were either healthy for me, a three-time breast cancer survivor, or if they are not appropriate as a means of detecting dangerous materials. I have been touched inappropriately five times in the last 15 months. Last Thursday was the first time here in Anchorage since the millimeter wave machines were introduced and put into operation December 9th. I wear spandex running shorts, actually capris, a tight camisole top. I have no breasts, so that as to show I could not be hiding anything. I believe you have a copy of my experience. If you don't, I can provide one. Another passenger who watched my pat-down was stunned as to the severity of the touching in light of what I was wearing. Coming back last night was not much better. Two out of five times in the last 15 months, I've been asked if I wanted to be escorted from the airport as I voiced my disapproval of how my Fourth Amendment rights were being infringed on. I tell them that they have Alaskans over a barrel because we have to fly. And so I grit my teeth and still get molested, telling them to do what they have to do just so I can go. This is all part of the TSA procedures. But no two of the groupings have ever been the same. They've been very invasive. Others have been trying to be nice. They find out I have had breast cancer. They try to be very friendly. It's still an invasion of my body.
Is it a male or a female that did your invasion?
Well, definitely they have to be of the same gender. They have been female. The TSAs are definitely female, and they grope me. I am an Alaskan and a United States citizen. I'm protected by two constitutions. You heard Representative Sisna read the Fourth Amendment, but I also want to tell you about the Tenth Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. So, when I say that the Fourth Amendment is being broken at these gropings, that means the Tenth Amendment should be adhered to, given the state, that means the state of Alaska, the right to protect its people. To be apprehensive about taking a trip to see my daughter swim in my pursuit of happiness is beyond comprehension. When I'm traveling within my country, I have forgone two trips already that I was considering because of this treatment. This has also caused friction sometimes with my daughter as we travel. What should have been a happy ending this last Thanksgiving gave way to an argument when I got emotional in the Palm Springs, California airport and embarrassed her. We've had passengers come to the First Amendment booth at Anchorage as I am a co-director of Alaskans Freedom to Travel USA, embarrassed that family members had to see private parts get touched or they were still seething after a flight with anger as to their treatment. Others missed flights because of refusing to move an infant daughter's diaper. Or have the machine in Seattle reveal a jeans rivet as a problem and they couldn't find it. And so the guy and his girlfriend missed their flight, incurring more cost to stay another day in Seattle before they could leave. Now there is the Viper program, that's VIPR, being introduced in bus and train depots. More invasive touching. I believe programs, as you mentioned, the Trusted Traveler, those are, to me, a dividing program. If I want to give background information, pay $135, that might be fine for me to get a little bit faster through the airport, but what about my daughter or other people that aren't frequent flyers? I've seen MVPs, I've seen families with children going through metal detectors in lieu of the scanners now, and that to me is also, to me that would tell a terrorist, okay, you just get a whole family together, go through the metal detector, you don't have to worry about these other things. The pat-down still leaves us unconstitutionally treated. I would love to spend my retirement years doing other things I enjoy for service to people, but I must tell you, I'm committed to changing the practices of the TSA. What is happening now is just plain wrong. And I strongly urge you to propel this bill forward. Thank you.
Well, before you go, do you have a suggestion? I mean, let's just say it's not TSA, but it's the airline, and they want to make sure that nobody gets on an airplane with a weapon of any kind or with any intent to cause harm to the airplane. Can you come up with some plan that could substitute for the one that's currently in place by TSA? And I'll give you an example. We all know the Israelis haven't had anybody damage an El Al airplane, and they don't do it the way we do it. And I could explain the way they do it, and it's interesting, but do you have a suggestion on how we ought to do it?
Well, I'll tell you what. One thing is, these planes that did crash into the buildings, 9/11, there was access to the pilots. You no longer can use a plane as a missile or a bullet. The doors are locked. There are supposed to be air marshals on board. To me, the passengers took down the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, and as Mr. Sable said, they did come from out of country. It was not, they didn't go into a bathroom to light these bombs. They were out in the coach area, and they were taken down. Now, I'm not a scientist, but what we have until December 19 in Anchorage, 10 years after 9/11, that's a metal detector. We have no problem, as far as I know. I've not heard of any kind of terrorists trying to get through the Anchorage Airport or any airport in Alaska. I am all for, I know there was a program called Puffer Program, and it was trying to detect explosives as you walk down a tunnel. I understand that didn't work. I haven't really studied to see what the problem was. I do know, not being a scientist, I do know that there are other methods of smelling explosives. I know I read an article called the Dogs of War. Dogs that have been in Iraq and Afghanistan every month. There's actually a dog that went in with the group that got Bin Laden. They can sniff 10 different explosives. They're trained to do this. There are dogs being trained that go and search out cargo areas that are supposedly being searched coming into the country. There has to be, with the technology that they set up to do both these types of scanners, the backscatter and the millimeter wave, I have to believe that there's smarter people than me that can get a method of smelling non-metallic types of terrorist materials without doing our constitutional rights down the tube. I just have to say there has to be better science. They're out there, we can put people on the moon, we can send spaceships out taking pictures. There has to be a way without touching me and without taking any kind of pictures of my body. And radiation is accumulative. I don't know if any people are aware of that. In my 64 years growing up, I've had many, many x-rays, whether they were teeth or bone or whatever. Radiation is accumulative. So when they tell you you get the same amount of radiation just flying for like 100 minutes on the plane, if that's accumulating in me, then I do not want to do anything else that would accumulate. So I know there has to be ways of finding whatever we have to worry about without invading our constitutional rights.
You know, I think the most advanced technology we have is the dog. In Russia, they crossed dogs with jackals. Jackals apparently had even a better sniffing ability, and they won't even sell one of the offspring to these to any other country. They're so proud of them, and they don't walk them on a leash. They just let them run loose in the terminal, and so everybody's got to be a bit nervous as these half jackal, half dogs go and give a sniff. But you know what? It seems to work pretty well.
Well, the dogs that have been trained for Iraq and Afghanistan, they usually do a Labrador retriever mix. However, there's another one called the Belgian Marseille or something like that, was the one that went into the Bin Laden with the Navy SEAL 6. This article, the Dogs of War, is very, very good. And I have people say, well, but other people are allergic to the dogs. And I go, well, you know, I've been down at this First Amendment booth in the airport, and I see all sorts of dogs go in and out of that airport. Well, you know, required that they're on a leash or in a kennel. So I cannot believe that we cannot have a very mundane, non-threatening type of canine that can smell. Or I don't care if it's a little robo, rumba, vacuum cleaner type little machine that roves around sniffing. There has to be a way of doing it that they don't have to touch me.
You don't have a view of the audience, but there's a lot of smiles here.
I'm glad. It's certainly not the most entertaining subject for me.
We have a lot of cancer survivors that have had more radiation than they'd like, and just getting a little bit more is not the kind of thing they think is a good idea. You can have a dog sniff me all day long, I'll just sit there and pet it. Thank you for your testimony. It's been informative. There's another person, I think, in the same group you are, Thomas Brown, Freedom to Travel.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Thomas, you're going to have to either get close to the microphone, telephone, or speak up a little louder. You sound like you're a couple of rooms away.
Okay, is that better? Can you hear me now?
A little better. Even more would help, but go ahead.
Okay, well, my name is Thomas Brown. I'm a medical co-director along with Patricia of Alaskans Freedom of Travel USA. And you've heard quite a lot of important things said today, and I don't need to rehash everything. I don't need to tell you about the violations of the Fourth Amendment rights, the fact that the TSA procedures will continuously target the most vulnerable amongst us, people with body issues like the elderly, amputees, anybody who's transgendered, that's with physical scarring. One of my main problems with the TSA is just the fact that they are a national, international embarrassment. It is frightening and disgusting to think that Israel, who definitely deals with terrorism more than the United States, they refuse to install the machines and they refuse to pat down random citizens the way we do. I know a Filipino businessman who's been coming to this country twice a year, every year for 40 years, and last year he refused. He quit his job and he will never come to this country again by plane because he will never subject himself to the TSA again. I lived a long time overseas. I lived for 30 years in over a dozen different countries. I was a mile away from a Red Army faction terrorist bombing in 1993. I served with the members of the USS Cole who got blew up in the 2000s. I was just a couple miles away from the discotheque bombing of Berlin in 1986. Terrorism exists, and we should do something about it. I expect my government to better allocate my tax money. I really don't see the usefulness, necessity, the wisdom in putting body scanners in Ketchikan or Bethel. I don't see hordes of jihadis coming through Kibbalina trying to kill us. I just don't see that as being necessary. I see this as a bloated bureaucracy, which is, it's a job creation program as of now. From the TSA website, you can see all the many things that they've confiscated, like snakes, turtles, birds,
birds, 240 pet fish, a 12-year-old science project that Seti scanned off. The one thing you will not find on the TSA website of things that they've caught is a terrorist. You will not see that they've arrested people for charges of terrorism. You will not find that because it hasn't happened. You've been asking everybody who's testified what sort of alternatives they have, what sort of suggestions they have for a replacement of the TSA. I'm not necessarily suggesting a replacement of the TSA, but their mission can definitely be refined, and the procedures through which they carry it out are without a doubt excessive and useless. The Israel refuses to install the body scanners, or the Israeli Defense Minister called them a laughable waste of money. I disagree with his term laughable. I think they're tragic. The pat-downs would not have stopped either the shoe bomber or the underwear bomber. There are plenty of studies that suggest that neither would they have stopped the 9/11 hijackers. And as a previous, I believe Patricia just said, once you've got locks on the airplane doors, that's kind of a moot point. We don't need to just have a laissez-faire, open border. Anybody can come and go as they will through an airport. But we do need to think about how we're using our money, and how our government is putting these things into practice. I could go on for a long time, but I just like to sum it up that this is, I've traveled a lot in my life, and I have a lot of family overseas, and the last 2 years, it's really kind of embarrassing how many jokes there are, how many just underhanded digs at us there are from so many people, because countries that actually have to live with terrorism don't do these things. And it's embarrassing to think that the greatest, freest country in the history of the planet is going to treat octogenarians and six-month-old children this way. And members of the committee, thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Brown. I'm going to add a little testimony myself here. I'm a cancer survivor, but I'm also a survivor of growing up in New York City in a rough neighborhood, Lower East Side of Manhattan. And I'll tell you, the only way to survive that, especially when you're walking in the streets in the dark for 20-something years, was by, I'll use one word, profiling. That was it. You took your chances, and if somebody, three guys are walking towards you, swinging keychains, you cross the street. If they cross the street, you ran like hell. That's profiling. But what do? We shake down a 80-year-old grandma with gray hair and freckles, and we let three students from Saudi Arabia certainly be checked, but it just seems like we're wasting money, time, and energy. And the Israelis, of course, have succeeded by exactly profiling. But we think it's unconstitutional to profile. I think it's insane not to profile in a dangerous situation. And I've made it this far. And let me tell you, when I go back to New York, it's not as bad as it was, but you're always looking around. You can ask the lieutenant in the back if he wants a free time, but when they pull up to a situation, they're looking around and seeing which guy is the most likely to cause trouble. I don't know how to avoid that. That's what you do. You should do it. It's your own survival instincts. So, now that I've given my testimony, Representative Lynn?
Well, actually, part of the conflict of interest, you know, I'm one of these older guys, and I do have a metal hip, so I get patted down every time I go through the airport or scanned or whatever. It always beeps. That's fine with me. Wife has a metal knee, same thing. She frequently uses a wheelchair going through. They do all kind of bum sniffing with little pads around the wheelchair. But earlier on, when we got some of the testimony that was given here, it seemed to me like we were equating the procedures, good or bad, at the airport screening with domestic violence, and I'm very, very uncomfortable with that because domestic violence is a horrible thing throughout the country, especially here in Alaska. And wherever we are on the issue of a scan or not to scan, pad down or not to pad down at the airport, I would like to keep that a little bit separate from what we think of as domestic violence. I think that's not an appropriate discussion we're having here. It's a different issue. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else? Looks like the committee is done. Anyone in the audience want to testify? Okay, Representative, come on forward and put yourself on the record. You can sit. Yeah, you can sit there. You can stay right there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just addressing some of the things.
Name and ID.
Oh, sorry. This is Representative Chris Tuck, District 29, South Central Anchorage.
Thank you.
And I'm here to test on behalf of the bill. And I wasn't planning any testimony, but since I'm next in line, I heard what's going on. I'm here. A few things. You know, it was only 1996 when the airlines first started checking IDs for people's air travel. So prior to that, I can purchase my buddy's ticket, or my buddy can give me a ticket, and I can fly in his name because I was considered a passenger, and I'd be able to get on an airplane and fly. That was 1996. After that, TWA Flight 800 went down, and a guy named Richard Clark, who was head of security underneath the Clinton administration, had looked to see how can we give the feeling of safety for travelers. And so they came up with the idea of checking people's IDs. They originally thought that flight going down was a terrorist activity. It was not. It was a mechanical problem. But still, to give people that sense of security, they started checking IDs. That was 15, 16 years ago. And look where we've come to today. Look how many rights and freedoms that we've had to give up to be able to travel and to try to travel with dignity. And I see this nothing more as security theater, giving people the impression that we're able to travel more secure. And if you look at what happened after 9/11, that was really unfortunate events, but these are procedures that should have been taking place right then and there, not 10, 11 years later. And now that we have these procedures in place, that we know that we can be able to put them in, unless there's some sort of threat, I think we've pretty much eliminated a lot of our threats. Gaddafi, Osama bin Laden, and so on and so forth. You look like worldwide, we've been doing a pretty good job of taking care of those threats. So when are we ever going to have the ability to roll back? And as was pointed out earlier, we do have more public awareness. We have not only cockpits being locked, but they're bulletproof. We have marshals flying, and how we used to handle security in the past was good old-fashioned police work. And I don't think this should be in place of good old-fashioned police work. And so so with that, I think there's some good points that were made, what goes on in Israel. Some people may call it profiling, but I know that they do a lot of interviews. They ask a series of questions, and they can move people, passengers, really fast. And I can't help to wonder what we're doing to our economy by restricting travel so much. That's the veins and vessels of our economy, is being able to exchange goods and services, and in this case, passengers and business flights. I think there are better measures to be able to put in place. As we know, drug smugglers have been hiding things in body cavities for years, and these machines aren't going to be able to detect drugs, so how in the world are they going to be able to detect bombs? And I think, as pointed out earlier, dogs are the most effective way. That's my testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate that, Representative Tuck. Anyone else wants to testify? Oh, we do? Okay, we have someone online.
Diane Schickman.
Diane, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead and introduce yourself, spell your last name, and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Diane Schenker, S-C-H-E-N-K-E-R, and I'm a mother of the co-directors of Alaska and Freedom to Travel USA. I think you have in your packet, I hope you have a letter from our organization in the packet that includes some of the stories that we've received from Alaskans that we've met at the Anchorage Airport and other meetings from our organizations. But those stories go through some horrible details about how travelers, including Patricia and other people, have been touched, men and women. And I would say it is an assault. And if you don't have the letters that I submitted, I'll make sure that I get them to you. But people are in tears. Women have been had these TSA employees putting their hands between their legs in a way that satisfies our state's statutory definition of sexual assault. The only reason it's not a sexual assault is this illusion that we have consented to this touch. And as many of the speakers have pointed out, that's consent under coercion, because if you have to travel for your job in Alaska, you have no choice. And so I would like to just really underscore that it is an assault. It's a sexual assault to have your breasts or genitals touched completely involuntarily. So the other question that I wanted to respond to is that somebody asked, what would you suggest instead? And we've heard some ideas about that. But I just want to also bring up, especially because of all of your experience being on the Judiciary Committee, but just like security at the airport, we have a crime problem in Alaska. We have a terrible crime problem. And I know that you all work very hard on that problem. And people have been working on it for my entire lifetime that I've spent in Alaska. And it's not solved. When I walk out my door, I am at risk of being raped and assaulted and subjected to all kinds of other violent crimes here, despite all of your best efforts and the efforts of everybody else. But what we don't do is we don't just say, well, let's just have all the men in the state have a curfew. They can't be out there because it's dangerous for sexual assault. Or let's just line everyone up and take their blood samples involuntarily. Or let's have let's pass a law where all of the police officers can just kick down every door in town every night and search everybody's houses and make sure that they're not up to something. We don't do that. And we have to find a way to deal with the crime problem without violating constitutional rights that way. And I submit that that's what we have to do with the airport. And I know it's a federal law and a federal issue, but if an Alaska citizen who has been sexually assaulted is a condition to get on an airplane in this state, and if we can't turn to our publicly elected officials to protect us, what can we do? That's all my testimony. Thank you.
Okay. Well, certainly appreciate your testimony. It's always good to hear from concerned citizens, and I have to congratulate Representative Cisna. Her bill has a lot of backup materials. We could spend a lot of time reading all the backup, and it's pretty well presented. And I'm of the opinion that it would be okay to pass this bill from committee unless I have some objections. Anybody on the committee feel like we need to hold this bill for another day?
Object.
Okay. You want to speak to your objection?
Well, I just think that, I want to feel safe when I travel. It's certainly an aggravation when I go to the airport. A lot of aggravation. It is an aggravation. But it's a bigger aggravation to be sitting on an airplane where I have some terrorist sitting next to me. I will blow up the airplane. I'm reading a book right now. My daughter gave it to me for Christmas on December 1941, and a lot of travel restrictions were imposed at that time, and some better, some worse. We did win that war, but it's something that you do sometimes in response. It's a balancing of the evils, I suppose, and, you know, risk versus reward. And I, for one, don't want to give up my security, or at least my sense of security, by eliminating these things. It's good that we caught the underwear bomber and the shoe bomber and all those folks, and then we finally got Osama bin Laden. But those are not the only people out there. We are in grave danger from terrorists, and tend to be terrorists, from all over the world. I don't think that's going to go away. And I want to keep my family, I want to keep myself and other passengers on the plane safe, and if it's a little bit of an inconvenience, that's tough.
All right, I'm going to do this. Representative Cisna, I'm going to hold the bill. I have no doubt we can get it out. What's the date?
Well, today's Wednesday.
Good thing. Day after Valentine's.
Yeah.
Meeting Friday.
We're not meeting Friday. We won't be back till Monday. I want to introduce the next bill, and at least so that could be heard in the future under bills previously heard. I really would like someone, especially you, to come back with the alternative plan. In other words, if we were writing a letter to TSA and we were king for a day, we would tell them to quit what they're doing and substitute, and that would be essentially the essence of the letter. Can we come up with a letter or a thought process that allows us to substitute? Because if we just write them letters and we don't like what you're doing, cut it out, it's going nowhere. And I'd like you to come up with, or your staff, come up with something that simply says, if we just didn't do the scanners, maybe everybody gets wanded. At least you don't. I don't want anybody groped, but I'd rather. I don't want a hand there, but if you're going to stick a wand there, I'm better off. And I like you to be blindfolded when you're doing it. I don't know how much pleasure they get out of this. I don't. But we've had so many video clips of some of these guys pulling the band loose from like a six-year-old girl who's in tears because their parents taught them, when somebody touches you here, you come to us and tell us who. And they're doing it anyway. So if you can do that for me, I'd appreciate it. Come back with something. Okay? So we'll hold this bill until Monday. I want to get Representative Tuck's bill introduced. So, Representative Tuck, can you come forward? They're taking your chair away, but don't let them do it.
Jurisdiction.
Okay, we have committee substitute for House Bill 293, which deals with victims' rights, one of our most interesting subjects. Everybody likes to hear about victims' rights. So we're not going to have time to do anything on the bill except to introduce it. So, Representative Thompson, can you introduce the committee substitute before us for consideration? My understanding, it's / M like Mike.
Yes, version M. I move version M amendment.
CS for House Bill 293, version M, for consideration.
Yes, for consideration.
Okay. Any objection to adopting the committee substitute for House Bill 293?
For discussion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time for discussion.
Well, maybe the next Sunday. Time, yeah. What I'd like is, and maybe towards the beginning of the next time we hear this, somebody to describe the difference between the CS and the bill.
Sure.
Yeah, I can do that very quickly, but if you want to hold off to next time, I'd be more than happy to. It's only a couple words.
This is on the amendment?
No, it's the change.
I would like a question answered instead of waiting till next time and have to wait again. On page 4, line 14, it says a felony of delay of 2 months or longer. Seemed like there might be a loophole there that they could go for 30 days and then another 30 days and another 30 days. Every time they come back, mm-hmm. You know, they could go up to 58 days and then come back in and say, oh, we need another delay. Oh, we need, you know, is there a loophole there that could make this thing go on in perpetuity?
So, briefly, you're going to tell us the difference from 293 to CS for 293.
Yeah, very briefly. So, if you look at Section 2, lines 12 through 15, that's what we were just talking about that Representative or Vice Chair Thompson brought up, is that there was a concern that there be a delay, so we actually defined those delays in lines 12 through 15. So
on page 4.
On page 4, I'm sorry.
Okay,
in section 3 on page 4, we added the words if known in the underlines there on lines 24 to 25. We added if known. So if the judge happens to know, we don't want to be able to hold up the defense's case as well. And if they happen to know what the crime victim's interest or their problems are, they'll be able to go ahead and make a decision then. And additionally, we did the same thing on page 5, line 4. We added it, if known, in there too. And that was as a recommendation of the Department of Law.
Yeah.
I'll withdraw the objection.
Okay. I'm going to exercise the privilege of the chair, and we'll hold this bill till Monday. Unless somebody has an objection, I will adjourn. Seeing no objection, we're adjourned.